Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take these, these huge stacks of source material and turn them into knowledge you can actually use. Today, we're not just looking at a different school of art. We are. We are demanding that you fundamentally re-examine your relationship with reality and with yourself.
Absolutely.
The core question that runs through all of our sources is radical, it's philosophical, and, well, it's in German.
Wer ist Kunst?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who is art? For this entire deep dive, we are dropping the traditional question of what is art?
Yeah, we're throwing it out.
And we're accepting this staggering premise that you, the listener, might actually be the masterpiece.
That's right. And this isn't just art history. It's conceptual philosophy applied directly to identity. We're charting a really radical conceptual movement that just blew the doors off the museum and redefined where art lives.
Which is where?
Specifically inside the human experience. We're tracing this idea from its initial philosophical pivot with Marcel Duchamp in the early 20th century, all the way through the post-war German conceptualists, you know, Booth, Orris, Bastel, who moved the medium from canvas and clay to the human body.
To consciousness itself.
To consciousness and even social collaboration.
So our mission today is to understand the powerful, and let's be honest, bizarre evolution of the idea that Jedermensch is Kunst. Every person is art. We want to see how this grand statement went from a piece of theory to a radical public performance.
And maybe most interestingly, how this truly profound society-altering concept is being adapted, disseminated, and, yes, commercialized in the world today.
Okay. So to get to the person as art, we first have to talk about the destruction of the art object.
You have to. Let's unpack that shift, because the whole conceptual liberation, it begins not with a paintbrush, but with a piece of plumbing.
Of course. We have to start with the grand architect of all of this, Marcel Duchamp, working around 1915. He didn't create art in the traditional sense. He selected a manufactured item, like a bicycle wheel, a bottle rack.
Or the infamous urinal.
The infamous urinal. He dubbed it the ready-made and simply presented it as art.
And the brilliance there is the philosophical move. By just choosing an object and assigning it a new context, Duchamp completely divorces art from skill.
From craftsmanship.
From craftsmanship, from aesthetic beauty. And he links it entirely to the idea, the context, and the artist's assertion.
It's all in the head.
It instantly raises the status of the idea over the object.
And our sources actually break down the different flavors of the ready-made, which I think is helpful to really get the nuances here.
Yeah, these categories show how he was systematically exploring that relationship.
Okay, so what are they?
Well, you have the foundational standard ready-made, the object presented, you know, completely as is. But then he started to play. The assisted ready-made is where an object is supported or combined with another, like that famous bicycle wheel he attached to a stool.
It becomes this weird new hybrid thing.
Exactly. Then you've got the rectified ready-made, which is less about combining and more about editing.
Like the Mona Lisa.
Precisely. He takes a reproduction of the Mona Lisa and improves it by just adding a mustache and a goatee.
A simple act, but a huge statement.
And finally, the semi-ready-made, which is really specific. It's where the object is only a part of a larger utilitarian item.
So in all these cases, it's the artist's minimal interference that creates the maximal conceptual effect. The question is always, where is the art?
Right. And if the artist can elevate a common object to art just by saying so,
then the next logical step, the jump from an object to a person, suddenly becomes possible.
And that idea had philosophical seeds long before Duchamp even picked up a snow shovel.
That's where the Novalis quote comes in, right?
That's the one. The real intellectual foundation. Every person should be an artist. It planted this idea that people are inherently creative.
But that still focuses on the action of creation, on doing something?
It does. And Bowies takes it further. He makes it less about doing art and more about being art.
And this is where we get that defining, just seismic quote from Joseph Bowies in 1983. He says, I myself am in this moment the work of art.
That means the person himself should become the work of art.
And this is the critical distinction that our source materials really hammered home.
Yes. Baez later clarifies that his assertion is emphatically not every person is an artist.
Why not? That seems like the same thing.
Because the word artist implies everyone needs to be generating a visible product, like a painting or a sculpture.
I see.
By claiming every person is a work of art, he's elevating the person's inherent status, their consciousness, their mere existence.
Wait, so Bowies is specifically rejecting the idea that everyone is a creator in that traditional sense?
He is. It implies that your inherent dignity, your unique combination of experience and thought, that is the finished product. Yourself is the sculpture.
And the choices you make, your biography, that's the medium being worked.
Exactly. You don't need a studio. You just need to exist authentically. It shifts the entire focus from external validation to internal self-determination.
So if the self is the sculpture, then how do you exhibit a living masterpiece?
You take that idea, you leave the gallery walls behind, and you quite literally put the person on a pedestal.
Which is exactly what happened next.
Precisely. This philosophical leap translated almost immediately into radical performance and body art, especially among post-war German artists. And the first person who really, truly walked the walk was Tim Ulrichs. In 1961, he declared himself the first living work of art.
He didn't just work in the total art movement. He was the movement. Our sources talk about his public self-exhibition in 1965.
I mean, showing yourself seems like the ultimate conclusion of portraiture, doesn't it?
It really does.
And he took that concept to its extreme, using his physical form as a permanent, undeniable canvas. He used tattoos.
Okay, we have two really striking examples of this. The first one, in 1974, was a target tattooed directly onto his thigh.
Such a powerful, visceral image.
Yeah, it is.
And it was intended to be. The sources frame this as a political statement. A living, visible target against the rising political violence of the time.
So if the person is art, then making that art a target is
a profound comment on the fragility of human dignity.
And then maybe the most definitive statement you could make. In 1981, he had the words, "The End," tattooed on his eyelid.
I love this one.
If your eyelid is the conclusion of the performance, does that mean sleep is the ultimate curator?
Huh, maybe. The source interprets this as the definitive end of his own life film. Every time he closes his eyes, he's presenting the final credits.
It's a total fusion of existence and aesthetic object. Just wild.
It is.
Now, we can contrast Ulrichs with the Italian forerunner Piero Manzoni, who was also using the human body as sculpture around the same time.
Yeah, 1961. We're talking about his base magica, Scultura Vivente.
The imagined base, living sculpture.
Manzoni, a true pioneer, essentially gave the power of artistic designation to the audience. He'd place a pedestal in a room, and any visitor who stood on it would instantly become a temporary work of art.
Okay, but if anyone can stand on the base and become art, doesn't that undermine the unique status of the artist? Is Manzoni trolling the art world here?
He is absolutely playing with the idea of authority. It's an act of conceptual humility, suggesting the power to call something art isn't just held by the creator.
It's about context.
It's context and it's conscious choice. The act of stepping onto that base gives agency back to the audience member.
All right, shifting gears a bit. Let's look at Ben Vattier, who took the classic mark of authorship, the signature, and applied it directly to people.
Vattier created a whole system for this. He'd sign the bodies and body parts of people in his gallery, turning them into certified artworks.
And he had like an almost bureaucratic system for it, the three colored stamps.
That's where it gets really fascinating. A red stamp meant the person was deemed a complete artwork lasting until their death.
Wow, that's a commitment.
A less ambitious yellow stamp designated only the signed body part as art, and then the truly ephemeral green stamp.
What was that for?
That referred to a specific limited state, like the person kneeling or eating or holding a certain pose. That was the art.
It's like a conceptual contract written on your skin, which makes you wonder how much control you have when someone else is literally stamping the terms onto you. Speaking of control, we have to mention Gilbert and George.
Ah, the singing sculpture, 1969. They stood on a pedestal, painted in metallic colors, moving stiffly to an old recording.
And their own instructions for their look.
Yeah.
This is key, emphasized being smartly dressed, well-groomed, relaxed, friendly, polite, and in complete control.
It wasn't chaotic at all. It was total submission to an external aesthetic.
So we've traveled from the idea replacing the object to the body becoming the new object. But Booz realized that if the person is the artwork, the implications have to scale beyond just one person on the pedestal.
That's the leap that makes Booz so central to this. And it brings us to his Erweiterter Kunstbegriff.
The extended concept of art.
Right. He asserted that art isn't just limited to objects in a gallery. It fundamentally encompasses human thought, language, and social collaboration. In his mind, life itself, lived consciously, is the highest form of art.
So, if life is art, does that mean how you filed your taxes this morning contributes to the overall sculpture of society? It sounds abstract.
It can feel that way.
We need to clarify Bose's famous distinction for our listener. Social plastic versus private plastic.
Let's break it down. Social plastic is the observable external dimension. It's the collective thoughts, words, and actions that form the world through collaboration.
This is his idea of social sculpture.
Exactly. It's the constant collective shaping of laws, institutions, conversations, all of our systems.
And private plastic. That sounds like the secret sauce.
It is the inner engine. Private plastic is your personal, internalized, self-determined core. Your beliefs, your values, your decisions.
The stuff people can't see.
Right. And the source material argues that a deep understanding of the person as art starts here. Recognizing your own private integrity is what then drives positive changes in the external world. The social plastic.
That's a powerful idea. The ultimate message is that realizing your art is about taking control of your own narrative, which in turn shapes the world. So if this personal artistic self-determination is at the core of human existence, then it needs to be protected.
Exactly. If a person's dignity is based on their status as an inviolable artwork, then we need rights to protect that art.
This is where the concept of construct comes in.
Art rights, yeah. Framing human dignity in explicitly artistic terms.
You know, for our listener, connecting human dignity to artistic self-determination is a huge conceptual leap. How do the sources justify that?
They argue that just as we protect a masterpiece in a museum, we have to protect the masterpiece that is the self. The core principle is revolutionary.
Wait.
The dignity of man as art is inviolable, and the obligation to protect it is the duty of all people. It shifts the whole conversation from political duty to aesthetic obligation.
That is a striking perspective. What specific rights do our sources detail under constructive?
They list several key concepts. Equality, meaning your artwork of self is valued regardless of identity or belief. Independence from institutions or the market.
Makes sense.
Freedom and choice to determine what your art is. Equal weighting of that choice in the social sphere. And maybe most poetically, secrecy.
Secrecy.
Yeah, the final choice of what counts as your art is up to you alone. It's the ultimate statement of self-sovereignty.
A truly profound application of art theory to liberty. Let's quickly mention Wolf Vostell, a contemporary of Booz.
Right.
His philosophy really just cemented this whole notion with his core belief. Kunst ist Leben, Leben ist Kunst, art is life, life is art.
And Vostell brings us directly into the present. If life is art and every person is art, the question becomes, how does that art survive in the digital commercial marketplace?
Which leads us to the contemporary application by the Joplin Factory.
Who engaged directly with this visceral concept, every person is art, flesh is art.
Flesh is art. That's a stark, almost disturbing phrase.
Yeah.
It pushes the body as art concept into some uncomfortable territory.
For sure. The source material shows their work focuses on the themes of flesh decay, and digital media. It forces a confrontation with our own material existence.
It seems like the logical, if grotesque, extreme of the body as art movement.
It is, but what makes it so relevant to Duchamp is their method of distribution. The Joplin Factory intentionally uses multiples affordable, mass-produced items to get these ideas out into everyday life.
So it democratizes the conceptual statement.
Exactly. Duchamp made art accessible by choosing a mass-produced object. Joplin Factory makes the concept accessible by putting it on a mass-produced item.
So tell us about the unusual merchandise that acts as their delivery system.
The merchandise is designed to shock you into awareness. They use items covered in this synthetic or photorealistic meat imagery, like
the Fleischtaschen, the meat bags.
Or the bulimia flesh clog, a shower curtain, and that truly visceral image of the flesh phone.
The phone covered in what looks like organic fleshy material.
Yeah. It forces you to confront the idea that the art you hold and the body you inhabit are fundamentally the same medium, flesh.
So what mechanism do they use to achieve that final personal confrontation?
They use the mirror. They call their concept the Spiegelschrei, the mirror scream. They integrate mirrors heavily into their exhibitions and onto their multiples, like pocket mirrors.
Why mirror?
The mirror is this powerful symbol of unavoidable self-awareness. It forces the viewer, you, to look at your reflection, and in that moment, accept the assertion that's plastered all over the merchandise, you are art.
Okay, let's synthesize this incredible journey. We began with the moment the art object sort of dissolved into the pure idea with Duchamp.
Mm-hmm.
That concept then became physically and provocatively manifest through the radical performances of Ulrichs, Manzoni, and Vautier, where the body was the canvas.
And finally, that physical existence extended outward, encompassing consciousness and striving for social transformation with Bay's social plastic and the proposal of Kunstrechte.
Right. The consistent message here is that realizing your art is a direct path to self-determination and critical thinking.
Absolutely. It's not about painting a picture. It's about choosing how to live.
But here's the challenge that these sources raise, especially regarding the Bayesian vision. If the conceptual foundation is laid, and the art world knows this idea, why does the revolution seem to have been indefinitely postponed?
That's the question. The societal impact where every person fully realizes their potential as a living, thinking, a masterpiece, it hasn't fully materialized.
We still tend to outsource our art status.
Well, critics, to jobs, to institutions, yeah. So what fundamental shift must occur in our perception beyond just knowing the facts for you to truly realize and exercise your existence as a work of art?
That is the ultimate persistent challenge these conceptual masters leave us with. And certainly something to think about the next time you look in the mirror.
Or consider your next social interaction as part of a collective sculpture.
Indeed. That's it for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.